I work for MSF Sweden Innovation Unit as a part of the MSF movement. And the panel today is about how to balance short-term results with long-term visions within the area of innovation and humanitarian innovation. And why we chose this topic is because during the 3 years that we've been ongoing, we faced a lot of challenges internally and externally. A lot of opportunities as well, of course. But what we wanted to do is to have a discussion about this. And many times when we talk about innovation, it's about this, the results, the big things happening, but not so much about the everyday work that we need to consider to make innovations happen. And with us, we have three very prominent panelists. I'm happy to present. We have Johan Karlsson from Better Shelter, that is responsible for the shelter outside the refugee housing unit. We have Kim Scriven from Humanitarian Innovation Fund, and we have Pascal Baudin from ICRC. Thank you very much for joining us. So what I wanted to do is just to start this panel by having a short introduction of our experiences within MSF Innovation Sweden Innovation Unit, and then to see how you what you think about this topic on how to balance the short and long term, and what is your perspective, how you feel it's similar and what's different. And what I want to do is to let you guys have 10-15 minutes to speak about your perspective, and then follow that up with some questions. And then at the end, we'll have half an hour to have a more open debate amongst all of us. And I think it's very nice that we are a bit close here. It's a bit bad at oxygen, but I think that we can manage. I hope so. So anyway, why we chose this topic with the long-term and short-term is that we already heard this a lot already before, I think, is that we have these visions. What can we do? What can we change in a big way? But that often collides with, in our experience, with short-term needs. And if we are dealing with humanitarian organizations that are very focused on emergency, that's the core area. That's what people want to solve. And many times that mentality is also brought back to HQ, and we always see this short-term needs that we need to solve and a lot of fires that we need to put out. And that is, of course, core, and we need to have that in order to do what we do the best way possible. But we also think that that creates some problem in the exploration of long-term capabilities and opportunities for innovation. And what we also noticed is that to do this innovation, again, as has been stated before, innovation happens when we have different perspectives, different stakeholders involved. And this is crucial to do it. And we have been trying to do this internally within many different departments, but externally with universities, different kinds of companies ranging from design-oriented to high-tech and others. And what we realize is also that this more systematic approach to innovation, it also is a bit heavier sometimes. It requires more administrations, it takes longer time, you have more people and stakeholders to manage. So we also realize that this requires a lot of patience. You just don't find the good matches right away. You find them every now and then, but you also have to have a lot of bad matches during that process. And during the process, we also realize that it's important to have short collaborations, that we have people that and stakeholders that we engage with in a small manner, so we get to learn each other. And by that, we also create trust. We can show to each other that we can deliver as expected. And in the end, also, it becomes clearer during this process what are the roles and what are possible to do. So in that way, we also need to be able to compromise. And just to take it down to this, I've been talking about patience, trust, and compromise. It doesn't sound very exciting. Not very innovative, but the fact is when you're going to throw yourself into the unknown, that are good things to have, and then you know it's a bit easier. At least that's our perspective that we have noticed so far. But this is just, I would say, still pretty much the beginning of what we're doing. It may look different in 5 years, 10 years, and it may look different from one organization to the other. So I think what's great today is that we have somebody that will represent another organization, Pascal Dodan, ICRC, that also they work in the same environment as we do. At the same time, we have Johan from Better Shelter that represents sort of these intermediate actors, right, that have inside in the humanitarian world, or at least that they see us as and the beneficiaries and the people that they want to use their products. And then we have Kim that will give us the sort of overview. They have funded a lot of different projects, so I think that's a nice setup. So again, this was mine and our perspectives. Now I would like to give the word to Pascal to say, how do you work around this? And I also want to fill in that Pascal, he replaced Tarun, that is the head of the innovation unit in ICRC. So he has a slightly different role in ICRC, but he will still, I think, give us a very good perspective on this.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, at the ICRC, where we are not so much advanced in terms of policy, innovation policy. I'm a policy person, so I would say on purpose we have left a lot of space for innovation for the last two years before, you know, a strong institutionalization of the innovation with a system or organization within the organizations. But I would say that the first question we may ask in terms of why do we want to innovate is what is at stake? And that's quite important for us because we are working not only in natural disasters, but specifically in conflict. And of course, the rules of the game are completely different. You know, in conflict, you know, the source of problems are usually the result of intentional malevolent action, which with physical effects. So it's not only to deal with people, you know, displaced by tornado, but displaced by militia or armed groups or governments. So you know, you have to inscribe the innovation, you know, thinking into that kind of environment, and that's absolutely fundamental in terms of do no harm, also in terms of long-term effect of so-called good solutions. I would like just to take a very short example, which is usually presented as an achievement. You know, the fact that, for example, we provide women in some camps with fuel-efficient stoves because they prevent them to collect wood in the fields or in the and to be raped. Okay, that's a pragmatic solution, but that doesn't solve the protection issue at all. And if you think that we solve problems through that kind of you know, technical solutions, I think we're completely wrong. So nothing against, you know, practical response to specific problems, but at the end of the day, you have to address the root cause of the problems. And in protection, usually the root cause of the problem are people or authorities or so we need also to balance between, you know, the some technical response and, I would say, protection response, démarche, etc. So you need to define the nature of the problem from the onset, you know, if you want to anticipate the problems in the future. Then the second question is, whom do we serve? Do we serve ourselves, or do we serve the beneficiaries? We innovate. How do you determine the interest of the affected communities? And this interest may be changed. You know, in the first phase it's life saving, and the second phase maybe it's livelihood. In the third phase maybe it could be education, etc. So you need to determine at each step what are the interests of the communities and what the kind of relationship we need to entertain with your stakeholders. And the third question is, what do you want to achieve? You know, on a short term basis, on a long term basis. It's difficult because, you know, the by definition conflicts are evolutive, non-linear, and problems evolve all the time. You know, what was, you know, probably at some stage seen as a relevant solution is not anymore on the long term. Another consideration is that we consider innovation not only in technological terms but also in the way we perceive. You know, the way we dialogue with authorities and non-state actors. We need also to innovate in that. You know, we are very, or humanitarian diplomacy, I would say, rather classic for the time being. Maybe we should use a new mode of operation in that regard. How do we design our strategy of influence? You know, we need to influence this, you know, parties to the conflict. How do we do that? Maybe the answer is not technological, but maybe methodology. And we should influence and we should invest in that kind of field. Protection, communication, etc. So we consider that innovation really covers not only technological issues, but also, I mean, the way we operate, procedures, strategies, etc., etc. And I think there's also very interesting questions in the way we can improve, you know, the way we operate and our respective strategies.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting what you're saying, especially that you deal a lot with man-made situations, and that makes it much more complex and difficult to deal with than if it is, for example, a natural disaster that it's of course a complex situation, but you can deal with it with different tools. So my question here is, if you have this situation where you have much more complex political aspects to deal with, how do you do reach this sort of short-term results and at the same time balance the long-term vision that you may have? You took the examples, for example, of women, that you could provide some technical solutions so that they could have better illumination and provide certain tools and so on. But how do you do that to anchor that with the long-term vision? Or do you think it's too far away to have this vision? They are so completely detached, so it's difficult to see the connection to it. And even if you have many different stakeholders that you obviously will need to have in order to solve these complex problems, how do you do that?
It's a very tricky question.
Yes, it is.
When I was preparing this panel, I said, are we so sophisticated? I think there's no silver bullet. There's really not. I think one of the, I mean, the old recipe is to really to assess and reassess problems all the time with the beneficiaries, with the authorities, etc. Just to not to be, you know, not to lag behind when there is a new dimension surfacing. So I think that's one of the solutions, is really to have a proximity with the people, and if new problems are arising, or new questions, or new demands, or new aspirations, because aspirations also change. You know, at the beginning you want to just to save your life, and maybe in the long term you want to educate your children. So just to be, you know, extremely close and have this dialogue with all different stakeholders. The second thing is to have some flexibility with standards. You know. I'm not a standards adverse, but I think we need to be a bit more flexible with standards, norms, planning cycle, etc., etc. We need to move away from a kind of solid type of planning and be a bit more agile, because that's the buzzword. The third thing is to be bottom up, you know, oriented, reality based, and that's. In some places, a problem, because access is more and more difficult in some places. You know, it's extremely difficult to be bottom up and reality based in Syria these days, or in Central Republic of Africa. So, well, that's And a third part is a very known notion, is the idea of do no harm. You know, just really to assess all the innovation in terms of unintended, or let's say more probably unintended effects on the people, and strike also the right balance between demands, speed, and quality. You know, because you can't have everything at the same time. You know, you can have, you know, relevancy and speed, and sometimes you have to do some compromise between these three aspects. And the last thing is to have a robust ethical framework. We are working on this issue now with people like Kim and others, just to build some set of ethical notions around innovation. It's the beginning of the beginning, I would say. There are, Oxford University has been pioneering this as well. But I think we need to, on the long term, have some sort of code of conduct or some sort of set of norms which inform our decisions when we try to innovate.
Yeah. So I hear also when you talked before about proximity, bottom-up approaches, and we know it's easy to talk about, but to do is much more difficult. And especially, once again, if it's a conflict area, and for example, Syria that you had as an example, is extremely difficult, almost impossible in many ways. But how do you try to close the gap from the field to the other stakeholders that you need to have involved? Because, again, you need to have it for the first period when it's just life-saving, and then it will change when it's about livelihood and eventually about development. And you also mentioned that we need to have more flexible frameworks and so on. Do you have any examples on when it went good, when any successful examples of this, and others that maybe that it didn't go so well, but you had some lessons learned from?
Well, Syria is a rather good example of achievement and failure. I would say that we have, partial access to Syria, but at the same time, we have this fantastic asset of the Syrian Red Question, who is our partner, part of the movement, the Red Cross, the Red Question, who help us a lot in the field to collect information, gather evidences, etc. I think without this partnership, we would be probably lost or just confined in Damascus and not able to gather information. But I would say nothing replaces this dialogue with communities. I see also during the framework of this discussion in WHS, you have this kind of trends where we tend to disintegrate people into needs, it's disaggregating people into different needs, which is very, very reassuring in terms of pseudo-scientific proof. But it's very dangerous because people have aspirations, people have strategies, people have, intentions, and we tend to narrow all, our reflections these days around needs. But people are not needs, it's part of the equation. So I think nothing will or can replace this dialogue and for example, to know that people have no intention to stay or they will move, people can build fantastic shelter, but they have other intentions in the future. So just to anticipate, the nature of the relevant response is really based on this proximity with the people and gathering data by all the means may partly fill the gap, but we seriously doubt that it would be a substitute for physical presence and physical interaction.
Thank you very much. And now move our focus to Johan Carlson from Better Shelter, that has done a quite interesting journey, I think. It started out as a freshly baked industrial design student. You had some ideas on how to improve the situation when it comes to housing and shelter for refugees, and 5-6 years ago, and now starting in Amna, a small place outside of Stockholm, very far away from refugee camps, and now you have you can see it outside here, and you're just about to produce 10,000 units for UNHCR. Please, how do you see about this long term, short term, when you made this journey? So
yeah, absolutely. We really started the journey, I think, from the opposite perspective of Pascal, for good and bad. that was it. At the time when we started out, it was before, it was like, now it was in 2008, I happened really to do a project for the the Swedish MSB, they call them the Swedish Rescue Services. They do some emergency relief after natural disasters. I was assigned for them to change the tents after the earthquake in Pakistan in 2008 to change the ventilation of the tents because it was basically too hot. So I had a product, you know, entry into to humanitarian relief. And as I did that project, and I also was working for other companies because this was just a freelance assignment, Swedish companies like Electrolux and IKEA. So that, wow, we should be able to do this differently. I was very naive at the time, which was a good thing, I believe, because it was just a thing, you know, we should be able to do it differently. And so, we did this ventilation for the Pakistan earthquake. We sent the tents, they went there, and they were there for 8 weeks. And then they were handed over, I think it was the UNHCR, who had them there and replaced them after 6 months with some new tents of another model, but still. So that was really the starting point for us. We could see that, okay, but this doesn't make sense without knowing the system. We know we're having, you know, the humanitarian needs always exceeds the funding available. And still we are working with emergency shelter that we replace very often, the stress costing, and started to talk around to humanitarian agencies about it. Why is this? Because it didn't make a picture. Then when I said, yeah, but there are. What I learned was that nobody likes tents as a product or prefab solutions because you want to go with local materials, and that's very good. So that's what an ideal world, what we want to do. We want to build, you know, capacity. We want to build resilience. We're going to, you know, have this response. But still, there are so many situations where that does not work because we have do not have the capacity locally. We don't have local materials to start with. Or we don't have the land rights. We don't have the right to build anything permanent. So we go on using these sort of the tenses. We have used them before, and that is costing us money. So I think that wasn't like an interesting starting point. Question was then to how do we approach and make sense of this? We had a small project with MSB. We approached the IKEA Foundation to say, because I happened to know the design manager at IKEA at the time, because we were doing furniture projects at the time, to say, okay, can we do something here? It really, you know, can we try to change this? And we were then also introduced to UNHCR, and that was. You know, to say who also they saw this need and they saw this problem greatly, but it was of course a huge challenge to go on and start with a big organization. I mean, we were really like, you know, a very small organization out in the middle of nowhere in Sweden, having this idea, and we shared the idea, and UNHCR they agreed with the analysis, you know, of the problem, but it was more like in the status quo, it's an acceptance, we can't change it. This has always been the case, but were people within the organization that we could tie with, I think, in common. So we wanted to change this, and if we go back to the topic, what is like the long-term result and the short-term result from a practical, you know, innovation perspective here. You know, when we started working with UNHCR, we had some people who believed in innovation very much, but we also had a lot of senior technical people who did not believe in innovation and not believing in us, this is a very young team coming from Sweden, you know, what can you do to change this? I mean, they could tame their enthusiasm about the project. And I think that is something that you often face in innovation, not only humanitarian innovation. You face it when you work with the private sector too. You know, when you do change, you know, it's not without resistance. And if we don't talk to what we can do to change this, I remember this, because we had a very tough time at that time. The technical manager, who's now a good friend of mine, and he's now retired from UNHCR. You know, he was really not, you know, like, you know, what can you do to change this? I've been working in this system for 40 years, and, you know, we had the same tents more or less today as we had 40 years ago. So that was a tough one, and we basically had a requirement. If you can convince this guy to work with you, you know, we will do a project. That's what I came from mission to it. But if not, you know, sorry guys, we're not going to fund you. You know, this is no project if you don't have them on board. What we did, And we didn't know what to do. First time around, we did a proper research. We, you know, we did all finding out the costing, the life cycle costs, and how much is transport, how is raw material, and we did all that stuff. It hardly impressed anyone in the first gate meeting we had for that project, because it was another paper. We went back and realized we need to change our strategy. So we knew that UNHCR was working on a self-standing tent at the time of frame, and they couldn't get the costing down. And that for us was fairly straightforward. We know how to get the costing down. We know alternative materials, aluminium that you can use. That is what designers, particularly in Sweden, you know, where we are, you know, as a designer, you work either for Electrolux or Volvo, and you know, it's about cost efficiency and design. So we did that. We talked to some steel producers in Sweden. We got material support to do this, a technical solution, and we brought it to Geneva. And then, you know, that okay, if you're going to throw it up this time, it's a close project. But we built up that prototype, and then the reaction was very, very different. Because people started discussing, and this was a very simple, like, steel skeleton, you know, thing that we had. And then the manager there at the time of the shelter section, he went to this, and then went to the middle and made a pull-up in the arm. So this was, you know, the rationale for saying this is a good project, not. And it worked, because it was strong, you know, it worked. It was not saying that, you know, this will work in any, you know, programs, or it would be some adequate solution. That was the... I think at least an 85-kilo man who made a pull-up. And there's not a rationale, you know, that you need to make a pull-up, at least that was known at the time that this is a project to invest in.
It was not a requirement.
It was not a requirement, and you know, linking it to the longer-term strategy, that link didn't exist at the time, but it was like, okay, but this is good, and then we had more people coming in. And then, you know, imagine what we could do here. We could have this staff accommodation, or we could have this, as, you know. So that really everything changed. And I think that was an insight that we had.
Was that the tipping point in some ways?
Because we have never been so close to be thrown out as we were at that time. We have been close afterwards as well. But, I mean, at that time, this was a different world where we actually could start a collaboration. Because I think then we could show that we could contribute something which UNHCR alone could not do. We could transform needs that they had in shelters and the problems into a solution, you know, that was in prototyping. Because they know shelter, they know programs much, much better, and they know when this shelter would be adequate and when it would not be. But then they realize, okay, we can do something together here. I think that's a key. What we have built to go this far is you need to build a confidence, you need to build a partnership in all innovation. And we have failed a lot in this process. We have many things that have not been ideal. So you need to build that trust and have that long-term partnership. And when things go wrong or they go over budget, because when you're working with innovation, you're sort of aiming somewhere, but you don't really know. You change the map as you go, because you get new insights.
You can put that general direction, but then you cannot figure out
that. No, exactly. But I think that was a problem we had seen in the previous humanitarian projects when we do the tents, because many other projects addressing this issue before. And we have seen many projects we have discussed in forums like these ones, what should the height be of, you know, a tent? Should it have 180 or 190? What should the wind load be? What standard should we have to, you know, in order to state fire resistance? What's an adequate level? And innovation doesn't work well, I think, in these forums, because then you get the standard, the specification that no one's buying into. No one has really tried to build something concrete out of it. So that's what we... So, okay, but we can build and write the specifications as we go and change it. I think that has been...
Successfully.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, it just helped us move forward. Yeah.
And I think when you talk about this, it's interesting to hear that you have several aspects that you've done, and many talk about that you need to have the outside perspective. You take out the guys that have never had any experience or very little experience of the field realities, where you have the experienced guys, the experts, and they know how it works. But you need sometimes to have this disruption to say, yeah, but we can try it in another way. And then also that you have the prototype. You could not convince with a paper, because people just get papers all the time to read. Here you have a pull-up friendly prototype, and that's what made your case continue.
Absolutely. You know, it does. And I think prototyping is really a strong tool to work with, you know, and, you know, particularly big organizations like UNHCR, because when you put up a shelter, because we have done many after that, we have done, you know, at least once a year, sometimes more often, we put up a shelter in the atrium in UNHCR headquarters. And then you have people from, because that's a very vertical organization. you know, you have the program people, the shelter people, protection, you know, the different units. When you come to the shelter, you know, start to meet and talk, and you can move across to innovation and make the organization make it comprehensible. So I think that has helped us a lot, and also to get a lot of insights and feedback. And that's how we started. Second phase was obviously to when we did the piloting in the field.
One question also, just to follow up what you've been describing, is how do you manage to sort of align all the different perspectives that are involved in this kind of project? You have on one side the beneficiaries or the displaced people that will live in these shelters. Then you have UNHCR as a big organization, at least to say. And then you have your own realities that you have to face, like creating good business models, production methods, and so on. How do you align this in a good way?
I think it's a balance. It really is a balance, and I think it's one of the hardest challenges that we have had in this project. Has not been the technical innovation as such. It's just been a balancing these different interests, maintaining, you know, good relationship with UNHCR, respecting this organization, but it's also very, very different from, like, the private sector we also work with. Because we work on a sector where we work on terms and conditions basically with private sector, but they usually have to pay their own R&D for us. So we very seldom pay for prototypes and this kind of stuff. And they're very happy to do that, but they really would like, well, we would see results very, very quickly. Whereas in the system, it takes time, and we are dealing with people in the field who are not choosing to live in these units. When you're normally in design, when you're doing vacuum cleaners for Electrolux, you know, we have a focus group or a market group, and you give the vacuum cleaner out, and then they use it for a couple of months, and you find out what's good, what's bad, and you change it. Here we are working with refugees who don't really choose this solution. They don't choose to be in this situation in the first place. So it needs to be handled with a great, you know, care to pursue a piloting to do this right. These things take time, which so often is in conflict with private sector. We would like to contribute, but I would like to see great results, and it's hard to find private companies who don't, I mean, usually want to go to business fairly soon. Okay, we do this now, but if it's good, you know, will you buy within the next 6 months or 12 months? And you need to have a much longer time frame in this to bridge these different perspectives, but also to make the entire organization realize, but, you know, the private sector, they need to get revenues in. If we expect them to ship in money and invest in this, they need to get that. So we need to meet them as well. So that's been a lot of needs, particularly on our what we call like our collaborative framework. How is it, the partnership agreements, intellectual properties, who owns what, who has the right to deliver, you know, to produce a solution if we would become successful. That has taken a lot of time. I think that's another talk, but that's really to set it in the first place. And we ran into trouble when things got to work well, because when things don't work well, then everybody like shipping in and we wait and see. But it's, in that sense, innovation. When you work with private sector, when you're not doing anything good, you know, there are not big conflicts. When you're doing something good, then you create conflicts of interest, because there are different people who claim they own the solution.
Yeah.
So that's what has been a lot. And then finally, back to the beneficiaries, which I think is the toughest part to get the feedback on. Because we are in a very different, and I think this is what UNHCR know very well, how to get the feedback, but it, even for them, it's very, very tough. Like when we pilot these units in Doload and Ethiopia, there are so many other interests which are not, has got anything to do with the shelter itself, where you make the survey. Because they may be thinking, if I respond in a very positive way about the shelter, maybe my friend may get the same. Or if I say it's too small, I may get a bigger one. You know, we're a big family, you know, they're all these interests. So that was very tough. Also, security was very bad when we did this service. So I remember once we did the interim test after 6 months, and I went there with an armed guard, and we locked on the houses and sort of, okay, how is this working? You know, it's very, you know, it's not an ideal survey, you know, format. We also had local anthropologists who served them, who you know, spoke the local language, and I think that helped. But that is very tough, I think, to derive good user feedback in this field, because it's not the vacuum cleaner focus group you're dealing with. There you have a different power relationship, and I think that needs to be...
Indeed, there is a difference there between the...
Yeah, absolutely, it's a big difference. And I think that is a great challenge. And to follow this up, and we are now thinking, because we're now started production, and we are now we are sort of a social company, which makes that we don't distribute any profit. We, any surplus we make, we invest in new R&D. So we are thinking about, and also we are setting out the, all the performance indicators, how do we measure success, and how are we not going to follow up that these shelters do what they are supposed to do, and when they're adequate or not. And that is, I think, everybody in this room is used to working with that. For us, that is new, and it's a great challenge. It would be to get this information, but we will get there. That's
very interesting, and I would like to ask you much more things. I think here at the end it was about the fundings and so on. So let's go to the guy with the money. No, so we heard the NGO perspective, also the sort of social enterprise. Are you that, the social enterprise?
Yes.
Yeah. And now I think it would be interesting to have the perspective of Kim Scriven that works for the Humanitarian Innovation Fund, and you have a lot of experience of funding and also having the overview of different projects, successful and less successful, I think.
Sure.
So please.
Great. I was looking forward to going last, but now I'm slightly dreading it. I think when we were discussing this panel originally, the concept for it, there were sort of two sort of cliches that I remember hearing quite a lot about innovation that came to mind. The first one was people saying, the reason the private sector can innovate is because it's innovate or die, which always makes me think, well, what is it in the humanitarian system? And the other one is from humanitarians saying, oh, we can't innovate because it's an emergency. And I think, well, surely that's the perfect time when you should be trying to innovate and trying to solve problems. But particularly as regards to what we've been hearing already, I think it's very interesting that we've got two organizations here that sort of proper humanitarian organizations, of which there are fewer and fewer, and have particular challenges around the innovation agenda, but also a more entrepreneurial organization, which is what we're constantly thinking we need to have more of in the humanitarian sector. I think the matchup of those is very interesting. From the perspective of the HIF, I think one of the things when we were set up 5 years ago that we were explicitly trying to do was to try and create, by the provision of funds, the space in terms of time and money for people to try and balance this need to be able to respond rapidly, but also have separate spaces where they can try and innovate, because there is that tension about providing financing for resources from internally and also staff time to innovation projects. It's important to sort of recognize that from my perspective anyway, the tradition in the humanitarian system around learning is very much, you know, it's an action-oriented system, and at its best it's a system of doers who are going out and trying to creatively problem solve. It's working and what's not, and then more formalized exercises in after-action reviews and evaluation. And I think if we look at the humanitarian system over the last 20 or 30 years, it's also gone through a real process of growth, but also bureaucratization as well, which has meant more standardization, more codes, more standard operating procedures. And I think I'm not criticizing it. If you look, you know, MSF, for example, has a fantastic resource of guidelines and standards that it uses in its programming to ensure quality in a really diverse range of contexts. And I think that's really valuable and has been an important thing. But when you take the tradition of learning that we have and that process of standardization, I think it's led to a system which tends to be one that learns in terms of incremental improvements to those standing operations and procedures that we have, which has been very important in making incremental gains in quality, but it's been less good at making some of the step changes in performance that we need to solve problems, and will push forward new ways of thinking, like radically moving from a tent to a different type of shelter. And I think that's important because it makes it harder for the system to respond to the bigger shock. My feeling is maybe the system did a little bit better last year in terms of the Ebola response in rapidly coming up with new ways of trying to tackle a problem that agencies hadn't seen before. But we'll have to see a little bit further down the road. The current sort of practice of innovation I would divide into sort of two areas. One is very focused on the short term, and the other is much more looking at the long term. The first is this innovating in response, the trying to improve whilst emergency interventions are going on. And I mean, from our perspective in the HIF, this is something that that we do less of. You know, we're mostly supporting organisations thinking about things in terms of R&D, but I think it is important to try and see what the creativity that's created at the field level during emergency responses looks like and capture it and document it. But the challenge for me in doing that, and I think probably why the HIF stays away from it or funds less of it, is, as Pascal was talking around, the ethical questions. I don't think they're ethical issues that cannot be overcome, but I think they're particular ones that need to be taken into account. What I would say in terms of our learning of seeing where it works is that it draws on partnerships, and it's where people, established organisations, see interesting innovations, other organisations working in emergency context, and start working with them. And I think that's where it's been particularly productive. And also something which I've seen in terms of funding, where people are trying to access resourcing for innovation through what someone at Oxfam working on their innovation was called Result 4, which is when you're putting in your program budget for an emergency response, your result 1, 2, and 3 are your sort of, you know, result 1 is your big meaty, we're going to save X amount of lives, and then results 2 and 3 are similar, but you know, maybe we're thinking about longer term things. Results 4 is the one that people care about a little bit less, because while it's sort of got that far down the log frame, the budgets are getting a bit smaller, and that's where you can think, well, what can we do creatively with? But to talk to the other side of it, the more sort of R&D focused, that's, I guess, more where the Humanitarian Innovation Fund has been working. Based on learning from the field, ideally with user input, taking that out of the field and trying to work on things in a more systematic way. I think what that requires to be done properly is what we would call innovation intelligence, which is that combination of learning from the field and ideally users with information about new technological or policy developments outside of field context that can be linked up, often through collaborations and novel combinations. It has to be done without any real, before you know what direction your innovation is going in. Has to be quite unstructured in terms of problem definition. So the work we did in Emergency Wash, we did a big analysis of what practitioners saw as being the problem and were committed to working on the problems that came out of that. But it was very difficult. I think we were empowered to do that because we were working cross-organisationally and we had a mandate to work in that sector. But it can be challenging, I think, for single organisations to commit to doing that sort of exercise. And I think there are still, outside of emergency contexts, those issues of how you create the spaces for innovation. But the ones that I would speak to are around tapping back into that experiential learning that you get at the field level and really looking at how post-response you can capture learning, capture new practice, but interrogate it and think about it in ways that goes beyond that incremental, sometimes called single loop learning, to look at where are the more transformational changes that can come out. And hopefully something like that might happen for the responses in West Africa we saw last year. The other one I think has been invested in a lot in recent years is the appearance of more sort of labs and units within organisations, which I think broadly has been a really positive thing about carving out a space in organisations for innovation. But I think it's really important that as those things grow, they continue to invest in what I was talking about before, which is that really positive feedback loop between HQ and field, because there's a danger that if innovation is centralised, it disempowers those people at the edges of organisations who are the ones who are having the experiences and insights which can best lead to innovation. So linking those things up, I think, is really important.
I think that's an interesting point that you take up, that yeah, you need to have somehow, you need to at least many start the different units and dedicate the people to work purely on innovation, but that is of course not the goal with innovation. It's just a way to make it clear and to try to find someone that can spread it somehow. And you said that there was an increase in this kind of projects the latest year. Could you tell us a bit more about the changes of the kind of projects that you have been financing since you started till now? What has been changed besides that? You explained there, have you seen other trends, or did we learn something during this? Or did you learn something? Should we finance?
I think in terms of our own portfolio, I think at the beginning there was probably some low-hanging fruit of projects that were looking for a bit of financing to go into the next step. One of the first things we funded was the IFRC in Haiti to do some beneficiary communications work, which was, you know, the seeds were sprouting already there, and so it was quite opportunistic to be able to come in. It was our first funding round, and that, you know, reached multiple millions of people in the first year or two. So, you know, but I think we quickly went through that low-hanging fruit and found that the level of processes and innovation management in the system is actually very, very weak. And so I think in terms of the proposals we get a lot that still don't really understand the qualitative difference about what managing an innovation looks like as opposed to managing an established ongoing project in terms of the agility and the iteration that's needed. And particularly for a lot of NGOs who, I mean, everyone beats up on NotFriends, but at their most negative, they push for that kind of results-orientated programming which doesn't do that rapid learning and that rapid iteration which you really need for innovations to be a success. I think more recently what we're seeing, which I think is a positive trend, is more of the smaller entrepreneurial organisations coming into the system and doing disruptive things, often with established partners. So I can think over the last couple of years we've funded Translators Without Borders, which I think was basically embryonic when we gave them a large grant.
So at the same time we had sort of increased funding of these more generic innovation units and so on, you also have smaller organizations that, I don't know, are they more specific and specialized in what they do in order to find a good area to work within that is not existing, or are they also general in what they're doing?
I think they're very specific, and I think that what you often see is it's either people coming from outside the sector with specific knowledge and skills who want to make those fit for the humanitarian system, or it's people who are coming from within the humanitarian system who have ideas and want to make things happen but can't within the established structures and confines of the organisations. But they do struggle to access funding.
Yeah, of course. It's not easy. Yeah. I want to thank you very much for joining, very much, and all of you, of course, for listening and contributing with your questions.
Well, thank you for being here.